Welcome to the News Pace podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Vedmore, and I'm here today with Courtney Turner. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
It's really good that we've made the connection. I'm sure that people who listen to this podcast who have already like come across your work will have said, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Because you're obviously into history in a big way, aren't you? So first of all, so I don't butcher things, because you've got more than one project going on. What is it that you do? You explain what you're doing at the moment and who it is you are in short form, and then we'll explore further.
All right. Well, how do I do that in short form? I do kind of a lot of things. So the main one is the Courtney Turner podcast, and that is spelled like Courtney. Yeah, I told my dad.
I love it. I love it. I love it when I have to keep checking a name constantly to make sure I'm so terrible. I always mix up E's and A's, and I don't do it with your name, so that's all right.
There we go. Yeah, I actually told my dad when I was in nursery school that he taught me how to spell my name wrong. And he said, no, you spell it the French way. And I said, but Daddy, we're not French. And he said, it's prettier that way. So that's the way you spell it. So
it is true. It's prettier that way. So Courtney Turner podcast.
Courtney Turner. Yes, Courtney Turner podcast. So that's the main one. I started it in 2021, like right in the beginning of 2021. And the short version is essentially that I was in Santa Monica, California, where the measures were very draconian. Everybody was wearing a face mask. And I'm hearing impaired. I actually learned how to speak by reading lips. I didn't get hearing aids. I do wear bilateral hearing aids now, but I didn't get them until I was almost 6 years old. So I didn't realize how much I still depend on all those nonverbal cues and reading lips for clarity of speech until all the coping mechanisms I spent my life developing were then stripped from me. So I found myself just really, really depressed and isolated. I was previously I was a CrossFit coach, and I was doing, I'm an aerial acrobatic performer. So I was doing aerial acrobatic performances, but I was also speaking with those performances. So my speeches were mostly centered around, I don't need to, you know, wax poetic about the value of, you know, physical training. I think we all know about the physiological, the cognitive, even psychological benefits. But what I really talked about was movement as a metaphor for life. So more of a philosophical kind of premise. And I talked about ways that we can use physical training to overcome adversity in other areas of life. And because of my unique birth story, my parents actually sued for my birth. I was considered the wrongful birth case. And
how does internalizing that go for you?
that's so interesting. I never thought about it really until, like, I didn't really think about the impact of that and what that meant until I tried out for American Ninja Warrior, and it was the first time I shared my story publicly on camera. And my trainer said to me, he said, "Courtney, do you realize your parents sued for your birth?" And you know, I never thought of it that way. And just to be
that's
fair,
that's really good that you did, that you didn't think of it that way. Suggests to me that you had very lovely parents.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, and my parents had always framed it that, you know, it was the angle that the lawyers took because they knew I was going to deal with medical and physiological challenges for the rest of my life. So it was really kind of the way that they, because the argument was that the doctor was dyslexic and he read the titer incorrectly, but if he had read it, he read it as 112, had he read it as 121, my parents would have aborted me. So that was the argument. But I never questioned that my parents loved me or that they were sorry they had me. It was never, you know, brought to my attention in that kind of a light. So it was very interesting when he said that to me, and all of a sudden I was like, yeah, I guess they did. They sued for my birth. And it was, interestingly enough, it was the same lawyer as the Larry Flint Hustler free speech case.
Oh, wow.
At the same time. So we were clearly not priority for him. But yeah, so now everyone knows how old I am too. But yeah, so it was, so when I was training for American Ninja Warrior, and I had, you know, that was the first time I really publicly shared my story. But it was through that that I actually discovered silks and aerial arts, because I have very small hands. And So in order to be able to use a lot of grip strength, and so in order to compensate for lack of surface area, I needed to build more strength, more grip strength.
Oh, that's
And I
intriguing.
saw that as being a really fun way to do it. So I used to do the performances, and I would speak about, movement as a metaphor for life and physiological training and my birth story. The cliff notes on the birth story is that I am blind in one eye. I am bilaterally hearing impaired. I was had heart surgery when I was 1 year old. I was born with hypotonic limbs. So for those who are not familiar with hypotonia, it's the opposite of hypertrophy. So when the bros go to the gym, like try and build muscle, it's the opposite of that. The neuromuscular connection was not firing, and therefore my muscles were not developing. So I couldn't turn over in the crib, lift my head, that sort of thing. Asymmetrical bone development, fine graphic motor impairment, stunted growth, there were all these challenges. They told my mom the best thing.
Whoa, that's like a couple of challenges there. That's
Yeah.
amazing.
So they
In
told,
that.
thank you. So they told my mom the best she could hope was find a nice institution for me to spend my life. So really, that's what I focused on in my speeches was that, people often think about, movement and training in a very physical capacity or psychologically or even cognitively. There's lots of, research that indicates that it is mitigates cognitive decline. But people don't typically, I think, with the exception of maybe Bruce Lee, they don't typically think of it philosophically. And for me, it really was such a teacher for because I mean, none of us face none of us avert adverse in life, but I was certainly faced with a large a quantity of it, from very early on. And so I recognized how that training would teach me I can do hard things and I can overcome challenges. And so that's what I would do. So all this to say that all of my events got shut down. I got fired from both of the gyms I was working at. I can't prove it, but I'm 99.999 repeating percent sure that it was due to politics. And so I was fired from both my gyms, and all of the speaking and performing events that I had were canceled in 2020. And I found myself very depressed, very lonely, isolated. I couldn't communicate with people because everybody's wearing a mask. And a bunch of I started speaking out on social media. So I remember the first day of the lockdowns, I actually thought, oh, this is a great time to write. And so many people had said I should write my story, and I should write it all out. And so I sat down with the intention to write, and at the end of 10 hours, I found a beautiful white screen staring back at me, and I realized this is not going so well. So I know enough about the creative process. I was like, I can't force this. I'm too anxious. I'm too depressed. I'm going to take a little breather. I ordered 11 books that night. I was like, I don't have time to write, but I have time to read. So, and I never get time to read. So I'm going to take a little time to read. So I started reading, and then I found myself wanting to talk to people about all these things that I read. And after chewing my mom's ear off daily, and she was very polite, but she I couldn't spend the rest of my life, chewing my mom's ear off. So I started posting on social media, and most of it was really just going back to my roots of philosophy, psychology, stuff that I really hadn't had the time to dive into. Because I was working, and I just really didn't have that kind of time. And so I started diving into that, and I started sharing some of that, as well as some articles, journals that I was reading in respect to what was going on with the quote unquote virus that, they were fear mongering us with. And what I found was I was getting so much pushback and things that I never expected to be contentious, people really argued with me about. And I found it so bizarre. I was like,
COVID was crazy, eh? Some
it was
really
crazy. And I
wild
realized,
arguments, full of fallacies, but people are holding on to them and closing their eyes, closing their eyes.
and it was so strange to me. I mean, it was really just things that I thought were just common sense or things that I thought were just not like, that wouldn't trigger people. I mean, a lot of the philosophy and psychology stuff I posted, I did not expect people to have such a strong reaction to. But what I realized is that your worldview kind of seeps through everything you do. And I think that's what people were resisting. It was okay, this is a divergent thinker. This is someone who is not towing the mainstream narrative. And even in fields that I didn't expect to be contentious or, oppositional. That was the stance people were taking with me. All this to not very, very long story, not so short. But all this to say that people had started suggesting that I start a podcast, and I had no idea what a podcast was initially. And I know it's very embarrassing to say somebody actually, and this is how embarrassing it was, because somebody suggested when they heard of my birth story, they were like, "You need to be on Rogan." And my response was, "What's a Rogan? Why do I need to be on it?" Like, I have since learned who Joe Rogan is and understand why they thought that, and why he's seminal to the podcasting world. But I didn't know at the time. So I started listening to podcasts and diving down, the rabbit hole, mostly of like the intellectual dark web. I had been reading on this.
Oh, that's a
Oh, yeah.
really interesting. Now we could talk about that for a bit because I went really deep and dark into that. Yeah, go on. Anyway.
And dark, I imagine, right? I would
Jo
love to.
Jordan Peterson follows me.
Does he? You told me that. I'm
What the
so.
fuck? I don't understand. Yeah, it scares me. It scares me.
It scared you.
Yeah,
I'm
it's like I got a
so.
mark and let us mark his door. Ha! We will return for this one. It's something along those lines.
I'm so curious about that. Yeah. So I
Yeah.
started, it was Roger Scruton who turned me on to, who even made me aware of Jordan Peterson. So I was reading Roger Scruton. And for those who are not familiar with Roger Scruton's work, he's a philosopher, a British philosopher. He's most known for his work on conservatism. And that was what I started by reading, because I was really just fascinated by this political polarization that had occurred. And it's certainly not new, but it was so extreme during COVID. I mean, it was like, you held an American flag, and people, I live in the States, and you would think that that shouldn't be polarizing, but suddenly people thought he was like alt-right, like crazy
There's
fanatic.
this feel, there's this obvious feeling that there's a loss of liberty happening in every single part of our life, and that we go to libertarian circles to try and get the answers for that loss of liberty. That's what I
Totally.
felt.
That's another conversation I'd like to have, because I think
Yeah.
that's being really attacked right now. So so it was just really fascinating to me. So I was reading Scruton, and Scruton is a really fun philosopher because he doesn't just write like on conservatism or political theory or political philosophy. He writes about like wine and beauty and, it's really fun. So I was just diving down, consuming whatever I could because I was bored and it was fun and stimulating. And that's where I found Jordan Peterson. I became, admittedly a big fan. I mean, I went like.
How many times did you watch a Bible lecture? I think I did the whole series like three times with a couple of them extras and all of, just it's almost indulgent. Like
It is,
they,
I mean, I read all of his books. I read Maps of Meaning. I watched the whole lecture series on Maps of Meaning, the personality course twice, the one that he did in, I think, 2014, and then again 2016, I think. So I really dove down that rabbit hole, and all this to say that I would the idea of starting a podcast terrified me, but then it dawned on me, I had an epiphany. I was like, I could have naked faith conversations, and that would be. It might save my life. Not to be morbid about it, but I really felt that way. I mean, I remember having a conversation with my mom. She's kind of like, I don't know how you're gonna like parlay this into any kind of business or anything. And I said, I really have no idea, but right now it might just save my life. So I think I'm just gonna move forward. And that was really how I saw it, even if it was on a Zoom interface or whatever kind of digital interface, at least I could see people's faces. And at the time I was going down the block daily to this liquor store because this very nice elderly Chinese man would honor my quote unquote mask exemption, let me take off my mask, and he would take his off because I was hearing impaired and have a conversation with me.
Oh
Really,
man.
it's not like it was
Oh.
so profound or, but daily he would spend at least
No,
20
no,
minutes.
no, no, no. From because from the out, it may not be profound at the time, but looking back on something like that, you realize how profound it is. Because I seriously, Chile was dark on the mask front, and I looked around and there was no one there to stand just on morally. If I had to go, if I had to go through what you've gone through, then it's even like. That's just compounded so much. I mean, yeah, go on, sorry.
No, absolutely. I know everybody felt it, so I don't mean to make this like, woe is
That's why
me.
I didn't complain through COVID, because I knew that there was people who had it much worse than me, and I was just like, okay, all of these crap things. I was traveling across the world backwards and forwards, and they were making me jump through loads of different hoops to be able to do all of this, and the depression of it, and the sadness, and the life was breaking down on all different fronts for everybody. I don't think there's a person I knew who didn't lose a relationship or gain some relationship as well,
Yeah,
because
that too. Yeah, well, there were a lot of blessings, absolutely. So I would go for like I would go an hour and a half away just so I could go hike on a mountain without being, screamed at by the police, or potentially arrested for not having a mask, so I could have a conversation with a friend. So it was a very dark time. Like that was when I had started the podcast. And since then I really have five shows. So I do a show with the it's called we started something called Piracy Media. Piracy Media is very much still in development because we are seeking funds for Piracy Media. But really the intention behind it is to aggregate the very atomized alternative independent media sphere. And so we do a show there that's called The Dialectical Dissidents, because I talk a lot about the Hegelian dialectic. And one of the guys who we do the show with is he's from The Last American Vagabond, Ryan Christian. And the
I
other one,
know Brian Christine, yeah.
Ryan, yes. And then the other one is Scott Armstrong from Rebunk News. And of course, Ryan's always talking about the two-party illusion, so it kind of ties in with dialectical dissonance. So that's we do that show. And then I started a women's roundtable group. And of all the shows I do, that's been the hardest to coordinate with any consistency. It's two of the women have left, so they don't live locally anymore. One of them was just tied up with other things. And then I've brought different people in periodically, but it's really important to me that that one be in person. I think that it's just, I always say it's like a counter to the view. It really has nothing to do with the view, but it's just, I've wanted there to be different voices from women in this space. And I feel like there's really not a lot of women in this
No,
space.
no. Oh, I think there's more. I think that it's really hard to explain. I think there's only certain people kind of get either in or allowed into this space, and we on the independent media see ourselves as being rightly better than the mainstream media. That gives rise to like this ignorant fallacy growing in people's heads of that must mean that I'm a better than everything else and I'm most important. And then there's individual actors who are really, there's a lot of people who are ignoring their similarities to the mainstream media and how they act.
I agree.
There has to be a point where we say, okay, if we're going to make a better media, then we've got to cut certain things out that they do to attack each other or
Totally.
attack us. I think that it takes just a little bit of dazzle for people in the independent media to be awestruck, like with some person who to most wouldn't be a celebrity, but because of an issue or a stance,
Yep.
is becomes a celebrity, and then of course that then leads to false heroes and all of the rest of it.
Alter personalities, right? Yeah, very
Well, I
much.
see that in the independent
I do
media,
too.
and I don't I just try and get involved with everybody and hope that I can work it out as I go along. But a structure would be nice if it could be worked out. And I think I worry about those sort of structures just because of the co-opting of those sort of
Oh,
structures,
I do too. Totally. That's a because I think I've told you my theory that there's like a counter-intel pro operation Mockingbird occurring, essentially. That's and I mean I can't prove it, but I very much feel it. Like that's very much something
I
it
had a
looks.
conversation with someone just an hour ago,
Okay.
like off the record, where they were
Yeah.
mentioning a big name that I keep hearing over and over, and I keep talking about over and over, who is funding loads of parts of the independent media behind the scenes, and it's pretty obvious that there is something going on. And when you trace it back, it all smells of agency. In my opinion, is
I'd be
So,
very curious. You don't have to reveal it here, but I'd be curious who it is because I very much
oh,
see
I'm
that.
just gonna say it. And
Okay.
RFK Jr. seems to be funding different media, and it's there was one person who was talking to me. They were saying they want to create this. I won't say who it is, but they want to create a what is basically a blockchain media platform.
I've heard of this, yeah.
There's a couple of different variations of this happening, and they said the only person that they could get any funding from would be RFK Jr.'s or a fund, whatever fund they use. That's the only one, and it seems they were like, we don't want it at all because we know what it comes with. And I think there's a load of people feeling that there's a co-opting happening. So I've been speaking about RFK Jr. because I watched him come into the independent media, and he affected not only my working life but my private life to an extent, and my personal life. So I am very wary of his presence. And when it comes down to agencies, people say, like I say, use fallacies all the time, and it's really easy to say RFK Jr. Was his father and his uncle were killed by the CIA, so he would never turn to the CIA. But then there could be another side that says, was not exactly why you'd want to bend the knee, because you end up being in fear for your life and compromised, and they've targeted you anyway. So I just see lots of links around him, and I keep hearing the same things from people. That's not the only person I've heard that from. So I get a feeling that they and I know that there's a network he's created that looks really like health. The ch children's health defense and stuff like that. You can't argue with it. You can't argue with it. It's right. Everything that's on it is right. Everything is right. So you want to support, you want to you think, but
Sure.
if someone's lingering in the background, you always know that the one moment that can be turned against us all, you know, and that's what I'm really wary of. So I'll
Yeah.
that's sorry. Sorry to interrupt
No,
you
no,
there.
no. And children's health defense, I mean, yes, it's interesting you say like it's right. And I, there's so much they do that's good. But there's also, like the little, because isn't this how psychological operations and controlled opposition typically works, is that it's mostly, I would even argue, and I've heard this from people in the military who do psychological operations or who did psychological operation warfare, and they would tell me that it's 90% truth, 10% lie. And I would even argue, and I've pressed them further on this, what they've told me about that 10% lie is oftentimes it's not even really a lie. It's like an omission, it's a context, it's a blurring of context or taking things out of context or situational, or it's but it's not necessarily even fully a lie. It's really, but it's enough to steer you astray. And that's why it's so effective. I always use the ice cream cone analogy. So I say like there's the ice cream cone, and that's you've it's yummy. You want to eat it. But that's the hook gripping lie. So it's something that hooks you in. It's very enticing, but it's not factual. It's not true, or it's not contextually true. It's not the
And
real line.
if
And
you
but it's
attack it, if you attack
well,
it, you
it's
look awful.
totally, but it's the mass line action. And then what they do is they put the sprinkles on it, and the sprinkles are the truth. And so it's got all these sprinkles all throughout. And so you keep licking the cone. You're like, oh, well, it
I
must be
love
true. I got
sprinkles.
another true. Yeah, it's more. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And before you know it, you've eaten this hook gripping lie. And I think that's kind of how it typically works. But yeah, it's something I'm very much seeing. And I think they're trying to do, part of what they're doing in the alternative media space is they're using these little cognitive infiltration in old order to splinter. So now you get all these different factions. And of course, as you mentioned, the co-opting, right? The larger that some of these factions grow, the more powerful they are, the more money that's there. I think there's a lot of genuine good people who really are just seeking truth and then want to share what they've learned and, hopefully help all of us evolve and weed through this mess, essentially. But there's also the reality of just, as you put it, situational pressures. People have They have their lives to lead. They have mouths to feed. There's just that's just part of life. And so, and then they're really the, so of course they, there's pressure put on them. Well, if they can make a living and they can, but then there's also just really the grifters. And I see a lot of this. There's, and my issue with those people, and the grifters come in two forms. You know, some of them really are just looking for the money. Some of them really are looking for validation and fame. And sometimes it goes hand in hand. But and really, it's the narcissists who, you know, it's like they just want to be pat on the back and they want all the attention. And that's not to be undermined or ignored, because that can very easily be manipulated. And my issue with those people is, you know, it's not that I wish any ill on them. It's just that they take, you know, let them do what they do, but it's that they take a lot of the trust and money out of the space. And then for the people who are really trying to do good, and you know, it takes a lot of resources to continue to move forward, right? So for those people who are genuinely trying to do good, and then they try and you know, build something, there's a lot of trust and money that's been taken out of the space for them. So that's my main issue with it. But yeah, I'm seeing it. And it's just as hard to ignore, when especially when you move around and you've traveled as much as we have, going to all of these different conferences and events, and you just kind of, and because I'm not part of like any big entity, I kind of sit back and I watch and I
You
see.
have got to be, or I mean, there's so many things when you talk about stuff. There's so many things we have in common on another level. I can kind of understand the type of person you are because I feel that I'm roughly the same type of person. I'm
Right.
really interested. I'm really just like I'm outside the group.
Yeah.
I didn't have an array of health problems, but I kind of did. I had Graves' disease, and it was a thyroid disease, and it
Oh,
didn't get diagnosed till I was 27, so I got down to 8 stone, and I was dying. I had to end up having radioactive treatment, and like have my thyroids chopped out and all. And before that, they just misdiagnosed me all the time. So I that the shaking I had started when I was like 12, 13, and that just continued through. And they just kept telling me it was normal, and all of the different things was normal, normal. And they would have said told me
gaslighting you.
normal
Yeah.
till death. But I feel that
You
we have the
normal till
same.
death, right? Yeah.
I feel that we have the same type of like read of people. I think that by what you describe, when you sit back and you watch people, that's massively important. And people who are the true grifters, when they don't know they're being observed, give all of their game away because the grift is really easy to see. You know, it's really easy. So I'm really interested to talk more on that, but I'm not sure because I've had a day yesterday arguing with Kirby Summers, who unblocks me every now and again and shouts at me about something because I wrote an article about her a few years ago where I showed
Oh.
she wasn't who she said she was and there was lots of lies and she wasn't a sex slave. She actually wrote a long blog about how she was a mistress and she did it for the money and she liked all the dresses and all of this. And so she made a lot of money off the Epstein case and selling this story that she was like them and then profited off that. And then when I exposed it, she wasn't very happy with me, of course. And we have a backwards and forwards every now and again. But I find that there has to be a reckoning at some point on the independent media. What do you think that looks like?
That's a really interesting question. What does it look like? I've been less focused on like a reckoning, so to speak. I've been more focused on trying to elevate the good, authentic people that I see. You know, like the people who I'm certainly no arbiter of, you know, of truth, and I can only see what I can see, and you know, trust what I can trust. But I the those that I feel are doing genuine, authentic, good work, I want us to collaborate. I want us to elevate each other. That doesn't necessarily mean we always have to work together. I mean, we can collaborate, but it's also just about, you know, supporting each other, because that is so much of how this works. Nobody knows anything until they're shown it, you know. So until they're pointed, you know, it's like, I don't know how to make this concrete. It's just like I wouldn't know of somebody's work until there was a way for me to see them, and especially if they're being censored or suppressed, or just, you know, they're kind of in the void and in the vortex, and you don't have a way of accessing it. So I I focus more on that. That to me is, I want the good, the people doing good work to be amplified and, independently. That's really what I've been focusing on, and just trying to shine light and keep moving forward. I'm a little, I don't know if naive is the right word, but I genuinely enjoy digging into information, and I'm a very curious person.
No, I can tell. I was one of my next questions is going to be like, when did you start like learning about things like Operation Mockingbird and being like interested in those sort of things? Because that's like, it's not traditional type of what we do is very traditional. It's you have to have something have had to make you want to go over there,
Right. Well, I will say that the CIA has always fascinated me, and it's in part because they tried to recruit me when I was 7 years old, and
How old?
seven.
Oh,
So,
wow. That's serious shit, man. These
yeah.
guys.
So, like, the narrative has changed as I brought it up with my mom. So I remember it really well. I actually, I remember the whole experience. I was in second grade, and they came in. They told me that, well, they told all of us, they told the class that the police were there. That's what they said. They called them the police, and they said they're just going to do a skit for you. And I thought that was a little interesting, but I grew up where my mom would always tell me, the police are your friends. So this was, the kind of the line that I guess they told children at the time. I'm not so sure I would share that same narrative with my children, but that was always what I was taught. Like, you wave to the police, and they're your friends, they're there to protect you. And certainly this is not to admonish, I think there are a lot of wonderful police who, people who go into
There's a couple. I do police auditing as well, so I'll say there's a couple. There's a
Well,
couple.
this is what my experience of it, and this is not to make a broad stroke statement because there's always exceptions, there's always outliers in every case. However, I would say that for the most part, as a general rule, what I've experienced is in rural areas, police tend to really be, good, honest people who want to protect their communities, the communities they live in. And it's usually communities they've grown up in.
This is interesting because this is going to be the opposite in France as it is in France. Because in France, the police that are in the countryside are the most corrupt. They're just all doing everything naughty. They're just running the place. It's all gangster land. And then in the cities, they're quite, no, they're still assholes, but they're just not as bad as they are in the country. But anyway, sorry, go on.
No, that's really fascinating. But in the United States, my experience has been, I've traveled Europe quite a bit, but not enough to have that experience, not enough to know. But in the United States, my experience has been that the city police typically don't live in the cities which I think is actually supposed to be illegal. They're supposed to live in the communities that they defend, but somehow that doesn't seem to always be the case. And they don't have the same kind of allegiance, the same feeling of, and they often didn't grow up in the city that they're, working in. And it just seems to be much more rife with corruption. That's been my experience. But anyhow, I grew up, naively thinking that they're my besties. They're there to protect me, and so they're doing this skit, and I would watch the skit, and I was very artistic always, and I had actually wanted to be on Broadway, so I was like, oh, I'm gonna watch this play that they're gonna put on for us, and this will be so fun. And the whole experience was odd to me, just because of we weren't really sitting, and we were in this, like, everybody was kind of scattered. It wasn't set up like a theater. It wasn't, okay, the seats are here and this is the stage. It was
You were
kind of,
set up by the CIA. It's all over
it
the
was all over the place.
place.
And so I, after this, they brought each student to the principal's office, and you were supposed to recount what you saw individually. And the narrative I then heard was,
Oh, I
that
see.
my mom had always told me, that I wasn't eligible because of my disabilities. I'm hearing and visually impaired. And so I always used to make the joke that my disability spared my soul. But apparently it's not really what happened. Apparently, it was in recent years that my mom shared this, what actually happened. And apparently they called, and it was interesting just to hear the first time my mom shared it, just knowing the dynamic between my parents, because my mom said typically when it was school matters, because of my challenges. Like oftentimes the school did call, so it was usually like, okay, you go handle this, you know. And she said this time my dad stayed and like watched over her, and they called and apparently said, you know, hi, you know, we your daughter has an eidetic memory. We would like to talk to you about recruiting her. And she I think she was kind of like confused at first, and she said, I don't think she's eligible, you know, she's visually and hearing impaired. And they said, okay, that's, you know, that's not a problem. We're very interested. And she said they really tried to flatter her. Like they kept telling her, this is very unusual. We don't recruit children, which is obviously not true. I mean, we just look at the declassified documents and, you know, all the MK Ultra experiments, Project Monarch. I mean, we know they recruit children. The remote viewing experiments they did, actually a large part was primarily focused on children. So it, we know it's not true, but that's what they told her. And so they kept persisting and trying to flatter her, tell her it was a huge compliment. But she said the big thing that got her was that they would need to take me away periodically for some time. And she was, oh, no, we're not doing this. And she said that she pretty much had to hang up on them. But what was interesting is she
Wow.
said they called for about 9 months until they finally stopped persisting.
That is unbelievable. Oh, we just take her away every now and again. You know, we're just the CIA. You can trust us. We're not going to do anything wrong.
Well,
Wow.
and my parents, I think at the time, you know, really thought the CIA is there to protect us, and you know, they had a very positive kind of
So
impression.
you
But
said, how did you say it? Because I've heard it before, but I did a something memory. You have a something memory.
eidetic memory, so
Eidetic.
eidetic, so it's similar to like a photographic. It's a, you know, like a visual kind of imprint
Is it
memory.
one that's developed because of the necessity?
I wonder that. Like, that's what I always assumed. I don't know, though. It, apparently, 2% of all children have it, and it's not present in adults. And it's slightly different than a photographic memory, but it's very similar. However, they say that the adults don't have it because it would stunt their emotional and psychological development, because it would be too hard to process everything. So it's typically not retained. But yeah, it was one of those things. I don't know if it was like a necessity because of my sensorial challenges, and so I developed that as a. My dad has a really good memory, so I mean,
I've
he
also got sensorial challenges, but it's a different type of sensor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I did a little bit of research into it because I thought it was interesting. But yeah, that was most of what I found, is that it seems to be present in 2% of children under the
So
age of
at some point it went away. And then
Yeah, I
did you
don't have
feel it?
it.
Did you feel it? Did you feel it go?
I did feel it.
Really? Oh my God, that's such
Yes,
a good question
because
then.
I used to, I was never like a very studious person. I was one of those people who was like, if I'm interested in something, I will dive in, but I do not like being told what to do, what to study, what to, I'm not a very, yeah, I'm
I'm with
totally
you. I'm with you.
present. Yeah. And so I was never good that way, but if I looked at something, I was pretty sure I could remember it. So when I would be in school, if I would like take a test, for instance, I would close my eyes and I would picture either, you know, what they wrote on the board, or, you know, the page on, I could remember the page, I could see the page, and I would see the page number. And, you know, I would go through it that way to try and answer the question. But I did notice as I got older, particularly, I think it stayed with me for the most part, but I would say like high school, college, it started to dissipate. I think it stayed with me longer. They say it's, you know, age of 12 is usually, and I guess around 12 was kind of when it was starting to fade. I didn't have that kind of, I think, I mean, I'm told often that I still have a really good memory, but I definitely don't have like an eidetic kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know what a good memory is. Sometimes I just remember stuff because it's passion, isn't it? It's more passion that
I
makes me
think passion,
remember.
and there's a lot of studies that have been done on that. Like, you know, when
Oh,
there's a
really?
heightened emotionality, a heightened sense of passion or emotional experience will strengthen a memory recall.
So I've had a sense that the reason why I like to go back in history so much is because I grew up in a 17th century reenactment society, reenacting the Civil War every weekend, and I was always dressed up in the 17th century, and with swords and pikes and cannons and muskets and stuff. So I had. Yeah, it was 8,000 people as well, so it's not like it's a few people on a field, and then you do battles for charity. I was in the biggest one in the UK, which is the Sealed Knot, and it's basically my dad had a regiment that was like 250 people, and every weekend we'd travel, and it's a big party on a campsite, and every Saturday and Sunday there's a big battle in front of a load of spectators, and all the money goes to charity, so it kind of like works in a nice loop.
Fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's just a festival with like closed off campsite. You see your friends all the time. You got a big beer tent there. There's got like capacity for a couple of thousand, and bands playing every night. It's a really good way to grow up. You grow up in the 17th century, but with music and good food and the rest of it. Like, it's a bit strange.
Awesome.
Or yeah, but I wonder if that's the reason why I get so passionate about history. When I'm going back through history, I can connect with it really easily. I can
Yeah, because you had enacted it. I would
yeah
imagine. So I don't know for me. I mean, I woke up really late. 2020 was when I woke up. I was not somebody who was like, like my
it's
fiance.
there's stages to waking up, though, isn't there? There's
They're very
stages.
well, absolutely. So this is really interesting because I don't think I would have woken up in 2020 if I hadn't had so many seeds planted earlier. So I think that for me, there were just personal reasons why I had too much cognitive dissonance around looking at certain subjects and looking at certain issues that were presented to me. And for me, I think a large part of it was I didn't know at the time. I mean, I thought my dad was a conservative. That's kind of the narrative that I was bought into. But in hindsight, my dad was a hardcore neocon, and I really
Oh,
didn't know. I
really?
don't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that at the time. I don't know that I knew even what that meant. But he was a hardcore neocon. And it's really interesting because around like 2016, my mom had said something like, you're actually much more conservative than your father. And I don't think she knew either. Like, I don't think she knew the term neocon, or maybe she did. But I don't think it was that connection that made her say that. But in hindsight, I realized, oh, it's true. Because he really was a neocon. And at the time I really was more of a quote unquote conservative. I don't know that that's
Did
how
you
I've.
know much about his, did you see much about his politics growing up then? Did you, I mean.
Yes, I did. So I started a board for school choice when I was in sixth grade. yes, I did.
Were you working for the CIA? Sounds like a
Was
Gloria
not.
Steinem project. That's what
It
it
totally is. I realized how duped I was. Now
is.
I'm like, that was such like a false carrot that was dangled for the conservatives. It's totally it's totally a lie because it's deceptive, rather, I should say. It's just people, they think it's couched in because they like the words choice and you're gonna have freedom, but really you don't have freedom because they're just putting it under another umbrella as a way to entice you by, putting financial strings over you. And now what they're doing with school choice is just really atrocious because they're trying to put it under the umbrella of private school. So
Can
now homeschooling.
explain for the people in Britain, can you explain school choice? Because
Yeah.
I there's a lot I can say about a certain period of this I've been investigating recently. But go on, go on.
Yeah, so school choice is this idea. So I'll just give you the context of when I was growing up. I grew up in a town called Englewood Cliffs. Now, Englewood Cliffs didn't have a high school, like it didn't have a public high school, rather. There was Englewood, which was a neighboring town,
A high
and
school desert.
yes, it was a high school desert. So Englewood had a high school, but Englewood was. It was very cliche. It was one of those towns that had railroad tracks, if you will. And, there was the good and, not so safe side of the tracks. And the school, the high school, was situated in the less, less safe, less less affluent area of town, and it was literally dangerous for whites. I mean, there's just no other way to really word it. But it was not really safe for anyone. You had to go through metal detectors to get to this, get into school every morning, and it was not a great education. You know, it was very
Wow.
low
It's a,
rank.
it would be bloody scary. I saw it on movies when I was young. The, like it, I couldn't imagine as a British person, like looking at American, some American schools back during that period is just so detached from reality. It looks like a dystopian environment that we would never accept, you know?
Right. Yeah, and we did. And so I had, there were other neighboring towns where, like, my friends from nursery school went, and my friends from, dance and gymnastics went, and they were just as close. I mean, in terms of mileage and distance and time to get there. So it's like, this doesn't make sense to me. Why can't I choose one of these other public schools? Why do I have to go to that school? And so I created this board for school choice. Now, the premise behind school choice at the time was that you would be given a voucher, and then your parents could choose which school, neighboring school, they would want you to go to. So, for instance, just people in Britain might not be familiar with this, but people here might hear that the term Tenafly was a neighboring town. I grew up right outside New York City. So it was very close to the George Washington Bridge. Fort Lee is right over the George Washington Bridge. Then there's Alpine, Tenafly. They're all kind of right around each other. And the Tenafly was a great school, very high ranking in terms of, quote unquote, test scores and that sort of thing. And so I asked, why couldn't I just go to Tenafly? And of course, I was denied. So I started this board for school choice, but this is why I want to impress upon people that it's very deceptive, because they use the word choice. A lot of people who might be on the political right, if you will, and I caveat that just because I think that's a false dialectic as well. Oftentimes it's just the Ouroboros really being fed to us. So, but for the purposes of this conversation, the people who identify as being on the political right, oftentimes they like hearing these words. We have freedom of choice, we can choose which schools, and we can take ownership of the education of our children. These are all lines that sound wonderful. And so they're selling it to particularly, they're really, there's a mass line narrative targeting the political right to have free, to have school choice. However, what it really is doing, and a lot of this is coming through UNESCO, it's being coming through UNESCO to through the federal and state apparatus. And what they're really doing is they're putting school choices under, they're extending the umbrella to private school as well. And what's happening now with private school is they're classifying homeschool. They're offering, and in, I can only speak to Tennessee, I believe it was, but they're doing this in many states in the United States, is that they're offering, I think it was $8,000 per child. Don't quote me on that. I might have gotten that number wrong, but I think it was $8,000 per child, which for some families is a lot of money. Now that's it. And the premise behind it is that we're giving you this money for books and for supplies and for, things that the student might need so that you can homeschool your child. But what happens now is you're under this umbrella of private schools through the school choice, and now they have power over you because now they can mandate that you do things like wellness checks that may follow the child for the rest of their life. They can require that they have certain injections because they're giving you money. Basically, they have leverage over you because you've taken their money. And so this narrative of school choice is just, it sounds like a great, it sounds much, it sounds too good to be true. And it really, it is. It's just not what it's being sold as. You don't really have the same freedom that they would like you to believe. The strings are being pulled. So,
But that's always been the same in that sense that I've well always I go back to what my experience of researching American school systems and how this sort of stuff can be like a part of a dynamic. I look at 1970, 1971. And when I was studying Stan Pottinger and all of his behavior around the place, well, he was first taken up in the Department of Health, Education and Welfare, parts of civil head of civil rights, and he was dealing with the desegregation. And then it became during that period, there was actually a rise in segregation in schools rather than because they were, you know, and there was a lot of course riots, angry people, because people suddenly had a reason. A societal like factor that said we need to now choose where we go. We want to go out to, and they weren't being allowed. But people were being bused for miles and miles to schools all around the place, and it just seemed like chaos galore. I mean, really reading about that period and what they were doing, it didn't make any sense why they were doing it except to cause the chaos. Why, while to st you know, to take away from all of the other things that were going on at that time, which is like Vietnam War and I mean, everything was an intelligence operation back then anyway. During that period, it's just everything's infiltrated and it's just everything's going about to go crazy because they're all, you know, everybody's spying on each other. And until Watergate, there's not like that breakdown of that, you know, there's the focus, the light on them. And then everybody's like out trying not to look like they were doing anything wrong, but everybody was doing stuff wrong for ages. So yeah, I went through the I didn't understand. I don't understand the American system. So I don't understand why you wouldn't have, but then I think it's probably this roughly the same now in the UK that and it
Think
was
it
when
will.
I was young, I went to a school and we were in a catchment area. So I think you applied for multiple schools and they sent you to the one that was right for the catchment area.
Interesting.
And I had a choice between two schools, I think, or three schools. And I would have loved to chosen the one that was down the road, down the end of my bloody road. But this was the line from, I think it was from my father. No, there's too many boat people in that school, and
Too
you'll
many
be
what?
attacked by knives. Boat people, which is what they were calling banana boat. That's what they would say. So it's like Somalis and people who would come over in abundance when in the early 90s were called boat people and stuff. So the and so I ended up not going to the school at the end of the road where most of my friends went. I had to go like 3 miles up the road just because of some other reason anyway. So it's like often kids don't get to choose their school. On top of it, the American system makes it almost impossible that you have to be forced into this school over here, which is really awful. And yeah, I mean, so which area are you talking? You're talking, is this in LA?
No, this is right outside New York City. I grew up in New
Oh,
Jersey,
that's okay. Yeah,
right over the
because,
Bridge.
right.
That's one of the dives I've done. I've
I
done a
thought
lot
you
of.
said, Inglewood, and I suppose there's multiple
There's an
Inglewoods.
Inglewood with an
Because that's
I.
Crim, that's like Crimshaw Boulevard, isn't it? The other one.
Yeah,
And
it's a.
that's like pretty. I mean, that's been, I loved rap music growing up, so.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of rock music from came out of that. Well, I lived in
Hey,
LA for
there's.
a long time, so yeah. But
All
no, I
right.
grew up in on the East Coast, so. But yeah,
Hey,
all
Aesop
the education.
Rock. Anyway, sorry, go on.
I love rock, all rock music. But yeah, so
Yeah.
but yeah, I've done a lot of research on the education system, and that's a it's model our the United States education system is modeled after the three-tier Prussian model of education. Which was born after the Battle of Jena, which was during the Napoleonic Wars. It was in 1807,
That
and it
was
was
one when Napoleon got his, like they had to retreat and everything, isn't it, in Palestine?
exactly. They lost the Battle of Jena, and they realized
1799. I'm going to say 1799.
no, it was
Oh.
1807.
Oh, eight, oh, right. Okay, much later.
1807.
Anyway, okay.
Yeah, not that far, but yeah, 1807. So
I like a
they
guess.
lost the battle, but they realized they lost the battle because the soldiers were dissident. They had rebelled, and they realized they rebelled because they were critical thinkers, and so they decided that they needed to establish an education system that bred mind, they literally said mindless obedient soldiers. I mean, that would be the translation, mindless
Wow.
obedient soldiers. And so they designed this three-tier Prussian model of education, and that model of education got exported to the United States. A lot of people point to John Dewey. I go a little further back. I would start with Wilhelm Wundt. Wilhelm Wundt was known as the father of psychology, and he I always point this out. It doesn't prove that he was, advancing the Illuminati agenda, but he is a descendant of Raphael. He was known as Raphael in the Illuminati. So he does have those connections. And then he was, of course, part of the Leipzig University. And he himself had no formal education, formal training, but he was the father of the PhD program. And he trained who was it like Pavlov under him, of course Dewey, Stanley G. Hall, and of course William James, who was the first PhD student. And William James is known as the father of American psychology. Really exported that system, along with, of course, James Dewey, who is very much sorry, John Dewey, who is very much instrumental in crafting the model of the education system that we have in the United States now. And John Dewey was a co-author of the Humanist Manifesto,
So
which
what years are this? Is this like mid 1800s?
this would be. I think it's around like 1880 was Wilhelm
Yeah,
Wundt,
okay. Okay,
Leipzig
that makes
Commission.
sense. Cuz I'm not sure if we talked about this before, but I did a load of research about how the German model was being idolized by Harvard and others during the
Yes.
1840s and 1850s, and the president of Harvard was just in completely in love, and they were writing long essays on how they really need just to adopt the Germans. Look, the British and the Americans, we just don't know it on this front, and we should look to them. And it's kind of the lurch towards the world wars I found. I felt
Well,
like psychologically, in a
very
sense.
much so, because there is a strong connection between the psychologists, right? These PhD students of Wilhelm Wundt, and then the Tavistock Institute. And the Tavistock Institute was originally created around 19. I think they started gathering the idea for it around 1911. 1912 was certainly when they congregated. It was a William
Wow.
Chapman Masterman was appointed to helm this. It was called the British Propaganda Bureau, and it was at the Wellington House. And it was called the British Propaganda Bureau because always in the name of quote unquote defense, right? The Germans had a propaganda bureau, and so they said, "Well, we need to craft a propaganda bureau."
Yeah, one of the people who worked at the German propaganda bureau, if I remember correctly, was Nahum Goldmann, one of the founders of Israel. Isn't that wonderful? That's about 1917. No,
Yeah.
before 1917. Yeah,
No,
but
it
no,
has to
around
be before.
1917.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know
Yeah,
what
yeah.
year it was in Germany, but yeah, it was definitely before. And so they had this British Propaganda Bureau at the Wellington House, and it was, of course, the typical kind of players were involved in a lot of the funding for it. It was Lord Alfred Milner, Rothmere, Northcliffe, the Royal Crown was very involved. I believe the Rockefellers and Rothschilds had some involvement as well. And then one of the first things they did was they had a meeting with 25 very well-known literary figures at the time. So it was people like, of course, H.G. Wells, and who else was involved? Chesterton. So some very prominent figures. Rudyard Kipling, who's a huge favorite of mine, if it's one of my
He's amazing,
favorite
isn't he?
poems.
Wonderful. Yeah,
But
amazing.
he actually did not make that meeting, but he was still part of the whole operation. And what they did was they crafted 1,600 pamphlets and books between them to create propaganda to garner acquiescence from the American British
So
populace.
was Gunga Din
Ancient.
just propaganda, you're telling me?
Yeah, to
Of
get them
course he
to
was.
engage
Yeah.
in World War I on the side of the
Yeah.
British. And of course, from there, they
Go, oh
start.
my God. I just didn't think I didn't even when I with Gunga Din going out and giving water to the men on the battlefield who are thirsty and needing, and it's only him out there. Everybody else is dying and deserting them, but he's there, Din Din Gunga Din, giving them the water. I should have seen it really, shouldn't I?
Totally, yeah. So they had a, and then they headed up what was called the Creel Commission. So this was George Creel who was appointed to helm this commission, and George Creel appointed Edward Bernays, of course, the double nephew of Sigmund Freud, whose nephew is the founder of today's modern propaganda machine, also known as Netflix. And he was actually, he went to my alma mater. He's a graduate from Hamilton College. And so it was Edward Bernays, along with Walter Whitman, who was a journalist, to helm this Creel Commission. And the job of the Creel Commission was to create propaganda for the United States, to get, to change the sway the populace on the side of engaging in the world on the side of the British. And this was a very tall order because they had to very closely advise and guide Woodrow Wilson, who ran on the campaign that he would not engage in war. And so they
No,
had to
sneaky.
really shift the narrative.
Which is the manipulation that you see, like the OSS and like really harnessing at the end of World War II as well, where they're pushing towards
And
new
Tavistock was
fronts.
very instrumental in that as well. They were totally engaged in propaganda for, they were behind, actually, and so was Creel, behind that whole, what I forgot what the campaign was called, like Stop the, I forgot what it's called, but it's the Uncle Sam, like We Want You, all of the pictures that they did for that. Yeah. So, and that was very much, George Creel, of course, ended up creating a
Stop
film commission. I don't know what it was.
the
I'm
hun.
totally
Stop
blank.
them, hun.
Yeah, but he of course then created a film commission. Like he went into the film industry, of course, to create more propaganda. So they, but I always think that this is so interesting because it was during that time, during World War I, when they were trying to advise Wilson, that they weaponized the term isolationist. Because I remember when Ron Paul was running, and he was very popular with, the political right, he was saying all the things that they that really resonated for them, but the one thing that they were able to weaponize against him was his foreign policy. So they would tell him that he, they would say he was a crazy isolationist, and we can't have, him running our foreign policy. And I remember even my father, he would tell me that. He was like, "Oh, Ron Paul gets a lot of things right, but his foreign policy is just Looney Tunes. I mean, we can't have that. That's just crazy."
I got memories of my parents saying stuff that now I realize is just them repeating what they heard on the news. That's just it.
It
Just it.
totally, and but I thought it was so interesting because I had friends. I remember I dated a guy at the time who was like a hardcore Ron Paul fan, and yeah.
Had a Ron Paul hat and a few badges around the place and
My
oh
dad was
wow.
like, "You can't listen to these crazy people. I mean, they're just Looney Tunes." And I'm like, and in hindsight, I'm like, "Didn't George Washington warn us against the two-party system?" And his reason for it was that it was a loophole for foreign entanglements. And where are we today? Yeah, that was his reason for it, because he said that
Yeah, he
it was.
was a clever one, wasn't he?
Well,
A
I
wise
think, I
one.
mean, I don't know for sure. I certainly wasn't there, but I think it's because he was a Mason, and he watched the French Revolution, and he watched the infiltration of the Illuminati in the Masonry. And a lot of how they infiltrated was kind of this Hegelian dialectic, manipulation. And I think he saw that and was like, we can't do that. That's he was trying to warn of the danger. He actually used the book. It's John Robison's book, Proof of the Conspiracy, which was published in 1789, or 1798. Look, but it was, yeah, and it was an admission of, like, he was an insider, and George Washington used that book as evidence that the Illuminati was trying to infiltrate and to warn the American public of the dangers of the Illuminati infiltration. And
And everybody worships George Washington to this day, but no one listens to the words he said.
say that again.
Everybody worships Washington to this day, but no one listens to the words that he said.
Exactly. It's so true. And
Yeah.
Jefferson used the book proof, the code of the Illuminati to warn the public. And that
Wow.
book was published the same year. So, yeah.
That's some amazing stuff. That's some of what when you were speaking then, and you were talking about if people are watching the video version and they're seeing my face get all really excited while you're talking about a certain period of time, they're like that those are my excited looks. If you can't tell, they're like, oh, whoa, yeah, she's talking about 1910 and 1911. That's my, I've done a lot of research in all of these different areas, but there's this one area that ties the two up that would I really need to investigate, and I'm touching on it at the moment with an article I'm writing that I'm 150 years ahead of anybody else on writing this article, I reckon.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. It's an amazing story, an amazing story. I think, and I'll say part of it because it'd be almost impossible for people to you people could go and re watch something about him on. I got a thing called Controller Virus on which it was my first attempt at making a documentary and saying, okay, give me see if anybody can help me make a documentary. But people enjoyed it. They just know there was no one there to kind of help me, and I was doing loads of other things at that time, and my life was changing. But really, it looked back at 1910 and 1911, and the people who were involved in the Manchurian outbreak of the plague that killed about 60,000. And it was the first time that the China had done an international symposium. The guy who actually run the symposium was a guy called Dr. Wu, and Dr. Wu was the guy who invented the N95 mask. He was the guy who thought that up. In actual fact, nearly all virus protocols, lockdown protocols that look for the vaccines, all are really here in 1910, 1911, because Dr. Strong got sent by the Rockefeller Institute by America. He was studying in Manila, got sent across to be the American representatives with his assistant.
The Rockefellers tried to set up in I'm not sure which what part of China I'm blanking, but they tried to set up a whole like university system to implement the allopathic method in China.
Jesus
It
Christ.
didn't work because after the first one, it became too expensive. So it didn't take off, but yeah, they and I was very curious about that because China uses, Chinese medicine is, very much an ancient practice and very different from
This
allopathic.
well, still 1910, 1911 is important for that too within China. As this is happening, there's a whole bundle of things. Just after the symposium happens, the last emperor of China is installed on the throne by the Japanese. So it's the Japanese take control of China, really, political control. And
Interesting.
just after, and all of these people are suddenly like working under a different kind of slightly different system, and they start to knock out Ch want and want to knock out Chinese traditional methods out of society because they're getting orders from the Japanese, and the Japanese are about to start testing on everybody. They're going to use the Chinese as guinea pigs. And so the Russians send a guy called Zabolotny, who's the first guy who found some sort of like a vaccine for TB by giving himself TB, I think, something like that. Or no, it was typhoid, sorry, or something along those lines anyway. But it was something, he gave himself a vaccine and he didn't get ill, and he claimed that he had gave himself the disease and he didn't get affected. But he was the head of the Women's Institute in St. Petersburg, and he was a big player. He wrote loads about what to do in when there's an outbreak, and to lock down and do all of those things. Well, at the same time, Reginald Farrar shares a name with Jeremy Farrar, got sent from England, and I think he's the illegitimate great grandfather of Jeremy Farrar, and that it's kind of hidden from history. And Reginald Farrar, he basically examined what was going on in Manchuria, and Futian was a place which had a full lockdown where they sectioned it up into areas and people had to have set passes to pass through. And there was loads of like lockdown mechanisms he examined, and he presented his findings to the Board of London when he got back in detail, and they had questions and answers, which is amazing. And they all went there with a load of people who were making like what was then state-of-the-art vaccination, potential vaccinations. So they were just testing. Hafkin's prophylactic was tested on people, and only a certain amount of people died. So it's okay. And it's amazing. They were going into prisons and they were saying to condemned men, we'll give you a virus and then we'll you try this out. And then and if you die, it doesn't matter anyway, you're gonna die, aren't you? And so there was just like, you know, they were testing on them. The Japanese sent Kitasato Shibasaburo, who was one of the most evil men in history. He, at one point later, once the Japanese took over, they cordoned off an entire Chinese village, gave them plague, and anybody who tried to leave got shot. So they all just saw, just to watch how, without food and with plague, how people were gonna just be fighting and ripping each other apart. Kitasato Shibasaburo used to do the most evil tests on people. I mean, really, like pre-Nazi, taking skin off people stuff. You know, really horrible human being of the highest order. But in 1911, all these people met together and looked at the whole of what had happened in this Manchurian outbreak, where out of the 60,000 people who died, there was only three who got the virus and survived, or got the virus, got the plague and survived. It was a pneumonic plague. So it was only three who survived, and they survived with really bad defects, like they had really bad problems afterwards. And it was described as not proper life. But that period, 1910, 1911, there's so much going on. There's this whole idea of a whole new world that they can create with medicine and science and all of these things that are happening all at once. And I think it partly comes with the creation of that explosive sort of creation, the creation of big explosions, bigger explosions, and that comes with it. But when you talk about that period, my eyes just like, it's like I'm on heroin because I want to know about that period. And it was a really special period. You're talking about as well that, you know, the founding fathers basically warning of the infiltration of things like the Illuminati. And is round table groups that got created during this period, are they just the product of that warning not being heeded?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't think that they're a product of the warning not being heeded. I mean, I think that they're a mechanism. You know, I see the round table groups as a way of it. To me, it's very much like the mafia. You know, it's a way of diverting the tasks and the attention. You know, the mafia boss is not going to be the hitman, but he's got a bunch of people doing his bidding for him. So, you know, if they're going to come after anyone, they're obviously not going to come after him because they can't pin it on him. So that's kind of how I see the round table groups. It's a way of being able to divert and create very intricate webs. And of course, you know, they do this all in secrecy, and so then they're able to, you know, execute their plans with a lot of leverage and power. Part of the secrecy is not just you know, to withhold the information. It's also a lever of power. And actually, Adam Weishaupt talked about that because he was a student of Ingolstadt. He was a Jesuit scholar, and he said that he modeled the Illuminati structure after the Jesuits because that's why it had the hierarchical structure, because he said that secrecy was one of the ways that he could entice people to feel a sense of clout and importance, and also to buy in. So that's, I think that's part of the reason. It's not, I think a lot of people think it's just to withhold the information so more can get done, but I think it's actually to hold a lever of power over somebody, because people want to feel like they're important and they're part of the in-group. So.
You seem to have such a vast array of knowledge. It's just like about history, which is just like fills in lots of the gaps of what I don't, you know, I don't know. And is that only over the past few years? Have you been reading about this stuff for a long time, or is this just like, are you because I think I'm a bit of a like a sponge for certain knowledge because passion. Have you
Sure.
got that? Is that what it is?
Yeah, and it really has been the past 2 years. I mean, as I said, I was pretty normie prior to 2020. You know, I was never on the like quote unquote left. You know, I was never like a crazy Marxist, but I was definitely, you know, I bought into all the
I
mainline
used to watch
narratives.
Stephen Colbert. I used to watch Stephen Colbert.
Oh, did you? I had a lot of friends who did, and yeah. I actually in when I was in college and right after college, I mean, I was an actress and I was in the film industry, and so I had really tried very hard to become like a not even a Democrat, just on the left, because I thought that I would have more friends, I'd be more accepted, life would just be easier. So I really tried, and what I found was the more that I tried, the further away from that line of thought I became, because I kept asking questions, and the more absurd the narratives became to me, the less justification for that line of thought there was. So I actually became more entrenched in my thoughts the harder I tried not to. But yeah, no, I very much towed the what you would call establishment, you know, American Republican narrative. And I started this podcast actually with the whole, you know, if we could just vote harder, get the right people in office, you know, we could fix this whole mess. And I started off, I remember I used to say that I thought that the Republican Party was behaving as controlled opposition for the left. And you know, it took me not very long before I changed it to no, the Republican Party was created to be controlled opposition for the left. That, you know, that was by design, and I very much see that now. So I think, no, I just started diving in when I realized how much I was being lied to about everything. And because I am such a curious person, I want to know why, and I want to know what is the truth. And I don't claim to have all the answers, but I'm also really interested in, you know, most of my early academic and just my childhood was really seeped in studying human nature. You know, I was very fascinated by, I read Freud when I was 9. I did an independent study. Yeah, I
I was
read.
reading Judge Dredd, man.
I don't know what that is.
2000 AD, Judge Dredd, or back in Mega City One, in the future. Anyway, go on, sorry. Definitely
Well,
comic
that
books,
sounds
not
interesting.
Freud.
Okay, well, it sounds interesting also, but no, I was reading Freud. I read Greek mythology as a very like very little kid. I was always reading like biographies. And then in high school, I wrote 285 page theses on dream analysis. My mentor was the founder of the Association for the Study of Dreams. I did an independent study in philosophy. I did like whenever I had the opportunity to do independent research. I did like I studied the pre-Socratics. I did a study on the trial of Socrates. My school actually published that. They published my dream work as well. So I just had a really strong interest in human nature and like why people do what they do. And when 2020 happened, I realized how much I was being lied to about everything. I just wanted to understand how do we get where we are today? Because it's really people. I mean, people want to pin the tail on the donkey. But the reality is, it's not like you can point the finger at one person. I mean, maybe there's a similar line of thought that permeates through, but I don't think you can say, oh, it's all the fault of John D. Rockefeller. Like, it doesn't work that way. You know, he was definitely, I don't think he was a good guy in a lot of respects. I mean, he was definitely responsible for a lot of the, you know, things that we see today that I don't look too favorably upon, but I don't pin everything on him. It's not. And he's just one example. You know, I mean, you could say Kissinger, the list goes on and on, but you know, or the Illuminati or whoever. It doesn't work that way. What how it works is you have ideas that get you know, weaponized and targeted through you know, mass line actions, literally. And you also have people who are they're sifting through. Everybody's just trying to live their life. And I think that people get they get wrapped up in belief systems, and that can create polarity, and it advances agendas. And but it really, it's the people that have led us to where we are today. And so that's what I wanted to study, and I wanted to understand how did that happen, and what can we do to preserve the free will of humanity? Because really, that's what I see as being at stake. So.
I have a fear that free will is a difficult one because we cede our will over, we concede all of
Ew.
the time to the other side. And I was trying to describe it to someone recently where I was saying, I ended up actually using Jordan Peterson as an example because they were saying, why do these people join cults, join lodges, join all of these different organizations? Is it just, are they all like satanic? Are they all this? Are they all that? And it's like, there's human dynamics of just wanting to belong and
Exactly.
feeling out a place. And when you go into a place where you find like-minded people, like, I mean, my godson come over earlier, and his dad is just like one of my best friends. He loves fishing to a degree that I can't even imagine. I just when I look watching fishing shows, I have no idea what's going on in his brain. It just looks fantastic. He's completely excited by just watching a ship on water and a guy going like this on the on a, a but he's enthralled and he's looking at all of the little gadgets. He's just like, oh. It's just what enthralls people, you don't know. But when you get into a group of fishermen, then if you've got like a load of people who are all wanting to be part of this gang, or suddenly find a group of people who are like-minded, akin, have roughly the same background, roughly the same education, they feel more comfortable around. They also, pat each other on the back, give each other good things. Yeah, it's all very nice, but there's always a person that needs to lead, needs to step out in front. And
Right.
that's what drives the evil in our society to an extent, but it drives everything in our society is the fact that the one person, usually the greediest or the deemed the more powerful than most of the group. So the reason why I use Jordan B. Peterson as an example was if you, when we, you watched all of his Bible lectures and is
I
a
don't watch all that's the one I didn't finish, but
oh
because
right
that was when I started to shift
yeah yeah
my
yeah
views on him. So yeah, but
well
I've
well
watched some of them. I have,
yeah
yeah.
he the crowd, the people he speaks to are in awe of him at the end,
Oh.
is they're just in awe of him. So he's like, if he's like up there is like this being that scares these people who are down below who come, and what these people do is they submit to this person, they submit to this power that this person gives in a public space with a lot of people, and that is how a cult is formed. That's how a cult is driven on, is that it just needs the one, because that person at the top can believe his own rhetoric and believe his own power and believe that it makes him more powerful to know this information. And what he's seeing in return is power, is an increased power, people submitting underneath and bowing their head and saying, oh, you're so knowledgeable. I'm going to listen to you more. I'm going to, we are so used to bending over to someone who's more superior in a way that we don't even notice. And it's our starstruck, especially on the independent media. When RFK Jr. come along, everybody got starstruck for a bit, and now they're all complaining about how he's an anti he's anti-Gazan, I suppose. He's still an anti-Semite, really. Because
Right.
they're
Totally.
Semites, so it don't matter anyway. I would say anti-Canaanite, because they're all Canaanites around that region. You don't want to trust them. 50 to 60% Canaanites, both Jewish people, and it is genetically. It's amazing. We always we're looking for the leader, and when the leader appears, that leader's ideology is what we follow. And so the people, the names you mentioned there, the people who just step out with a good understanding of the ideology of power, I suppose.
I absolutely agree with that assessment. I think that that's right on target. I think what happens is that it creates Gnostic cults. So essentially,
Oh,
it's.
this is what this person was speaking about. She was speaking about Gnostic cults
Oh,
in general.
really?
Yeah.
How interesting. Yeah, that's really how I see it. I think that it's not the cults, and I think this has always been true of humanity. I mean that this has always existed, but I think that it has become much more codified and much more weaponized since the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School, they took the identity politics and really they carved that that strategy of using identity politics in order to create factions and groups and to strip people of individual identity in order to have people, they prey on people's desire to belong, the social nature of humanity in order to be part of something bigger than themselves. And so they create these groups. And of course, this is I talk about the Hegelian dialectic a lot, and a lot of people have heard thesis, antithesis, synthesis, or problem reaction solution, and those can explain it, but really his wording was actually, he said abstract, negative, concrete, and it was really the thesis, antithesis, synthesis came from John Gottlieb Fichte, who he was very much influenced by
So what's the
John.
original? Sorry, I tried to remember
Oh,
it and
the
then I get.
thesis, antithesis, synthesis is what John Gottlieb Fichte codified. It was taken after, it was his interpretation of Kant's dialectic, right? Like Plato had the allegory of the cave, he had the intelligible realm, the dividing line, the unintelligible realm, right? The people watching everything on the shadows on the wall in the cave, and then of course the unintelligible realm is out there, the world outside. And that really, I would say, was one of the first really strong codifications of this dialectic. And then Kant had his, which was the thesis antithesis. I don't know if he actually coined it that way, but that was how Fichte interpreted it. And that Hegel felt that that was too abstract. And it really, when he says it's too abstract, I think what he meant was it was too intellectual, and he wanted something that could be used as methodology. And he had his science of what was the science of phenomenology, which is where he talks a lot about this. And it really, he was trying to create a methodology for advancing the historicity of man. And the historicity of man for him would advance towards an omega point where, for him, he believed that the state equaled God. And so, all the power should be in this all-consuming state, which would, lord over us. And so what he said, abstract, negative, concrete. The reason I bring this up a lot is because the negative is the term in German was aufheben, which means it's an oxymoronic term that means to lift up and preserve while simultaneously tearing down and canceling. And then, of course, from the Frankfurt School, we get aufheben to Kultur, which is cancel culture. And I don't think I need to explain that. Most of us are familiar with cancel culture these days. But they really were masters of this stripping people of individual identity and creating this aufheben culture that was tied to identity, what we call identity politics now. And I think part of why they did that is because of exactly what you're talking about. I'm sorry, this is so long-winded, but it circles back to
No,
exactly what
fine.
you're describing, because I think as human beings, we do have a sense of wanting to belong. And it's survive for survival purposes, because we are social creatures. And in, Paleolithic man, if he was isolated and left to fend for himself, the chances of him surviving were very slim. That's why being ostracized feels like a physical threat. Oftentimes, when we're rejected, we fe actually feel it as if it were in danger. And it's because, our emotions and our consciousness, or our, I should just say, our technological capabilities may have advanced over the past, however long man has been on this earth, but our biology hasn't changed all that much. And so we are still hardwired very similar to the way that we were even thousands of years ago. And so that feeling is still, oh my gosh, I'm in danger. And so they have capitalized on this and exploited this in order to create these groups. And then what do you have with these groups? You have, they weaponize compassion, because then you have this, mama bear that surges as the Gnostic
Oh,
leader of
the
these
Gloria
conversions.
Steinem. You're talking about Gloria Steinem and feminism. You're talking about Gloria Steinem,
She's a Gnostic cult.
a CIA construct who constantly changes, like morphs and transmorphs her being. Oh, now she's a bunny who's a reporter doing an expose, and suddenly feminism dawned upon me, and now I am going to push out all of the voices of feminism and just be this bland version of this
She's the
overarching.
authority.
Yeah,
Authority
and she
thing.
makes Ms. Magazine and becomes the authority, and all of the radical feminists are pushed out of the feminist movement very cleverly, very much like it's a CIA program run by someone who was working for the CIA for 10 years until she set up the magazine, and then she wasn't working for the CIA. So yeah, the mama
Right.
bear, yeah, perfect, you're
Okay.
describing her.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So they weaponize the compassion, because what happens when you look at the trait of compassion, typically this I talk about something called like the I call it the compassion traps that they create. And you look at there's the trait of compassion, and that's typically we identify that with the we associate it with women tend to be more compassionate. But what is compassion? If you look at what compassion actually is, I'm not saying men can't be compassionate. Men absolutely can. But typically we associate that with women as being much more compassionate. And here's the reason. It's because what is compassion? We often think of it as being empathy, but it's actually not. It takes empathy one step further, because empathy is identifying with another person's suffering. Even though it's not sympathy, you may not have experienced it yourself, but you feel for that person, for their suffering. But then compassion is the desire to want to alleviate that suffering, the desire to want to, remove that suffering for that person. And that the reason women do tend to be more compassionate is because they're compassionate to their offspring. It's a again, it's survival. It's to protect their offspring. But what happens when you present a threat to their offspring? They're not compassionate to you. They become vicious, ferocious mama bears. And that's what happens with these groups. So you now have these figures that they're these Gnostic figures, they're the all-knowing, they're the expert, the authority who preside over this group, and now they protect their group. And so everybody outside the group becomes the other. They're the enemy. And so they now protect. And it's much easier to get people to fight against each other in groups than it is if we all retained our individual identity. And you see this through all sorts of, yes, the CIA definitely did this with what's the biggest division we could create is between men and women. So of course the feminist movement, they're going to otherize men. Men are the enemy. So now you have this hero, this leader, this, essentially this Gnostic demiurge
The
that's
patriarchy. That's what it is. They talk. That's what they. That's. I mean. That's what Camille. Palia. You don't pronounce the G. Camille Paglia says. They use fuzzy words like patriarchy that mean nothing, but it's to be able to offset their own shame and not achieving, it
Well,
seems.
yeah, I think it does a bunch of things, so a lot of these words are typically they're signals to the initiate. So, it's a way of signaling like, hey, this means you're one of us. They use these words, but it's also a way of creating the drawing the lines. This is our group. You're outside of the group. This is who's inside our group. And then, of course, it's a way of demonizing, it's the evil patriarchy. But I agree with you. It is a way of justifying their lack of I wouldn't even
Well,
necessarily
that's
see
Camille Paglia who says,
who said that.
and
I don't even think.
I kind of there with her.
Okay, yeah, I don't even think it's so much about achievement. It's more about because I think that's kind of a false premise that's been projected onto people, right? Because what is achievement? Who's deciding the standards for what it is to achieve? And I think a lot of that was even a feminist construct. Because you look at, you look in previous generations, women didn't mark their self-worth by how high up the corporate ladder they ranked. You know, there it wasn't It wasn't determined that way. So, and I think there are even still people today. I'll never forget this actually. When I think I was about 6 years old, and my father asked me what success meant. And it really struck me. I obviously, because I still remember this conversation. And I said to him, well, I said, I think it's very personal. I don't think there's like a metric for success, because what might be successful for me might be different for you. It depends on your value. You know, what your values are, what you hold dear. So, some woman might determine her measure of success by the family that she's raised, and the type of children that they grew up to become, or how her children grew up, or I or the farm that she's built, or who knows. I'm we could go on and on with all the hypotheticals. But I think it's just, and some other woman might say, oh, I'm successful because I make, seven figures and I run this corporation. And it's not for me to judge what one person's success versus the other. But I do think that there are a lot of narratives constructed around what it means to be successful. And, when in the case of feminism, I think a lot of it, we were sold a lot of lies. Women were sold this lie that you have to, at least it, what I saw in the United States from, growing up, was just like, you have to go to college, you have to get this, degree, then you have to get this job, and you have to make this
Kind
money.
of looks like the standard model. Kind of looks like
Right.
it.
And in reality, was that going to make somebody happy necessarily? And then you're stripping them of these prime fertile years, right? And I mean that literally. I do think that was by design. And that's not to say that you can't build families later. I'm not that this whole new manosphere red pill, like whatever wave of red pill we're on now. Some people argue with me. They tell me it's not really the red pill movement. Maybe it's not. But what I'm seeing, I don't subscribe to that. I think it is so toxic. And this idea we all need to be trad wives in order to restore humanity. It's like, okay, well, who instituted the version of trad wife that you are saying we should all model? And why are we demonizing healthy, flourishing relationships and families? Like, that's not productive to the flourishing of humanity, right? Like, they're not the enemy. The people who are in healthy, successful relationships and who are breeding, healthy, successful children, those aren't really our enemy. So why are we attacking? So I see that's not what I'm saying, but I do think that it's just that we've been sold so many lies, and a lot of it was designed really just to stunt the progress of humanity. I mean, progress in the literal sense of the word, the actual procreation of humanity. So.
Completely. I feel that there's also a automatic extreme that people go to once they realize, oh well, the whole world in the future looks like it's going to break down, it's going to be dystopia, I'm going to move out to the middle of nowhere and hide away. That's some, that's one of the many extremes that doesn't make sense when you actually play through strategy of what happens if society breaks down and you need a social group very close by to survive ensemble, because when things properly break down, you don't want to be in the middle of nowhere with no protection. It's the worst place to be. You've got all the food, have you? Oh, you're self-sustainable for how long? They're going to take everything. But in the same way, that's the idea, is that we have to fight within our societies so that we can live out in the middle of nowhere. If you want to live out in the middle of nowhere, you've still got to kind of like be part of society in some way. So maybe that's I think, when you say trad wife and you go in that, people are going that route, and people are going the same with traditional life and trying to get off the grid and stuff. There's obviously going to be, however much society gets pushed, it's obviously going to be some sort of output the other way. So there's, and it always gets more extreme. So I was thinking when you were saying that about a woman who I saw on a TikTok, I think it was on Twitter or something, and she was there with a baby wrapped around her, and she's giving this whole trad wife speech about how it's the greatest thing ever, and she's the greatest thing, and my husband does all of this because I like it, I love it. And it's like, it is true. It's, there's lots to be said about stereotypical sort of relationships,
Sure.
man being strong and women being less than strong but fruity, where men
Okay.
are hairy. It's the differences that make all of the unique bits. But we, I mean, this is all about homogenization, isn't it? I mean, what we're
Yes.
seeing now. So, okay, right, to start winding it up,
Okay.
what do you see our future looking like then? What do you see, like, I'm not going to say, like, oh, 2030, we're all living in mega cities and we have nothing and we're happy and all this. That's ridiculous. Like, that's not going to happen by 2030, obviously. But where do you see us in, like, 2050, 2060? You've got a good understanding of history. Where are we by then?
So I think what they're scaring people, I hate to put labels, but we'll call them like the truther movement or the quote unquote dissident people. A lot of them are being very I think they're being targeted with this fear narrative that we're all going to be chipped and we'll be cyborgs. And I don't want to discredit any of that because there's certainly a initiative. I mean, we can just look at, I try to point people towards the AI World Society that they're building. This is UN 100, the centennial of, because the UN was created in 20, in
The Royal
1945.
Society is so fucking evil. It's
So
so evil.
evil.
So
I
evil. Full of
think.
the most evil people in rooms going, meow, 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 doing evil things. Terrible.
I'm with you. And I really think they are trying to create a cyber Satan. That's at least what it looks like to me. So so they're talking about the, and you can go on their website. It's all very public. It's an AI world, the AI World Society, hence the name, and they're doing it in partnership with Boston Global Forum. It's a Michael Dukakis, who was former governor of Massachusetts, and they have a book. It's called "The Remaking the World: The Age of Global Enlightenment." If that doesn't sound new agey enough for you, just take a read of it. It is AI. It's new age merging with AI and technocracy, and they're using Ukraine as a hub, is what they're talking about. They have a symposium on rebuilding Ukraine after the war, and they're decimated, and we have to rebuild Ukraine to create this AI
No.
world society, which is going to be connected to all these smart city grids. And it's very, very dystopian. So I don't want to undermine any of that. However, I think there are a lot of people who are not going to sign up for the Neuralink and the chipping of the brains, and or even chipping under the hands. I know some people already have, and there's already. But here's the reality. And of course, whatever they can do to create, a cyborg kind of transhuman world leading to post-human. And I mean that literally, there's a handbook. It's called the Handbook of the Post-Human World. So, this is a real thing that they are trying to foist upon humanity, or post-humanity, I should say, rather. But I think the bigger concern is that is something we're already facing because they're creating, I don't know how familiar you are with cybernetics, but this is a term and a philosophy that has been around for a very long time, way preceding the, our smartphone technology. And it's this idea of this brain technology interface. And, yes, a lot of the technology that they're working on and that they're trying to foist upon us is very dystopian and very, it's transhuman, like robot-like. And that's a possibility. However, there's also just how much psychological manipulation is occurring through targeting through our social media interfaces. And the best way that I can explain this is I remember growing up where, we had magazines and we had film and TV. And if this is going to sound silly and superficial, but I think most people can relate to this. Certainly the women, probably even more than the men, but I think men will relate to this as well, where we had these very kind of Photoshopped images being thrown in our faces, right? It was, you opened up the magazines and there are these supermodels. And yes, we can argue that even outside of them, they were probably beautiful people, but they're completely airbrushed. And it's just not, it's not even what they look like in their day-to-day life. However, it was just magazines or an isolated incident when you went to the movie theater or turned on your television screen. And when you stepped out into the world, and even if you, particularly for someone like me who lived in New York City and LA, I would see these people. And the reality is, they're most of them are like everybody else. You know, they have their days with their hair in the bun and no makeup, and you know, but they don't look like the images that are presented to us. So we have reality to check against the images that are being presented to us. And that was very, I think, essential to the well-being of humanity. Because, and again, I'm being bringing up a very superficial example, but I think it's one we can relate to, because we had checks and balance against the false reality that was being presented to us. What is happening with us spending more and more time on our screens and, you know, our social media platform is that the lines between reality and virtual reality, reality in the physical domain and the virtual domain, is becoming increasingly more blurred. And so we're becoming more susceptible and vulnerable to, you know, really psychological warfare that's being targeted through that. And we don't have as much of a buffer, because if you, I think most of us have experienced either a dream or, you know, like a deja vu type experience. Oh my gosh, was that real? Was that not real? Did I live that? And what's now, I think, starting to happen is, wait, was that real, or was that like, you know, something that happened on Twitter, like, you know, just for an example. But people are literally arguing with bots, and they don't necessarily know they're arguing with bots. Some people do. Some people still have that discernment. But what happens when now SAG has redone their, you know, their agreement? They had the strike, and people were cheering about it, but I don't think it's a great deal. Basically, what it is your name, like, license and likeness, right? And so they're incentivizing people, and I think a lot of people are going to sign up for this. They're incentivizing people to give up their likeness in order to, because they get paid on it, and they get paid on the residuals. So now AI, it's machine learning. A lot of people talk about the singularity is near, or we're already in a simulation. I don't really think we are, but I think they're trying to push us into a singularity. And the more, I don't think that there really is sentience. I think there's no evidence to point towards the sentience of, you know, AI. However, the machine learning is advancing, and the input is being increasingly exponentially fed. And I think what we're going to see, you have now, like, I posted a video of like a singer who it was completely AI generated. Now, if you watch her, you can kind of tell it's not quite real. But what happens when we're so used to reading what ChatGPT wrote, or we're used to seeing things that were created by AI images, and we start to have trouble discerning what is real, what's not real? And that, to me, I think we're increasingly in danger of entering a metaverse that's not quite the way, you know, it's not necessarily a world of totally robots. While that concern is there, obviously, you know, they were already saying how, I mean, we already go to, you know, Amazon One is like eradicating, you know, any checkout counters, and you just go in. I walked into a gas station that had this. They had all these cameras that watch you, and then they see you pick stuff up. You go up to the register, it's already calculated what you purchased. Right. So, I mean, a lot of this technology and infrastructure is already here. And now, with what they're doing with biometric data and collecting it, I mean, we see the 2050 EMT. They're using all this biometric data in the name of healthcare. So all of that is there, but I'm really concerned about now we have autonomous drones that are being, that US military, the Pentagon has said that autonomous drones can decide whether or not to kill humans. So I'm not painting a gray picture here, but these are the kind of things I am pretty concerned about moving forward. And again, this will really further strip away our freedoms, our, you know, potential for being put into some sort of a, you know, like China's digital, you know, social credit system. I think that'll be further accelerated by a lot of these blurs of reality. And it does take away from, you know, what does it mean to be human? So Not to be all doom and gloom, I still think that we have a lot of potential to derail their plans. In fact, I do believe that we have derailed a lot of their plans. I think we've at least slowed them down or made them have to pivot. And so I what I just encourage people to do is you talked about like people going off the grid. The way I kind of look at it is I think the cities, people are being pushed into the city to create the digital presence. And I think that the people who go off grid are going to be a lot of the serfs, the slaves, because they're going to have to, work the land. And I think it's going to be a way of kind of enslaving them if we even have anything real left, because of course they're, all the geoengineering and now they're creating fake food. They're at an alarming rate of what is being converted into fake food. So, there's debate on that. Will you even be able to farm? But the reason I brought that up is because I do advocate, at least in the short term, whatever self-sufficiency people can have, whatever personal sovereignty you can retain. I don't think people should isolate themselves if they go off the grid. I love the idea of building homesteads. You have like-minded communities, you have communication systems established that are off of the electronic or cyber things like satellite kind of communications, and really where you can have reliance networks that are built within. So I think people taking their children out of indoctrination camps and homeschooling them, teaching them practical tools too. As a I'm obviously a lover of information. And so, I think sure, teach them information, history, obviously the foundational math skills, and if they're gifted, push them in that arena, challenge them there. But really practical skills, things that are that we laugh at today, like home ec, men learning how to build things. Give them the foundational tools so that even if they're not going on to get advanced degrees in applied mathematics, they know basic math. They know without punching it into a calculator, they know basic geometry so that they have visual spatial skills when they go out into the world. People think geometry is just a list of proofs and algorithms and equations, but it's not. It's really viewing the world and being able to adjudicate, like, will something fit here? Can I move this couch into this corner? That's a lot of geometry, and it really can be hands-on practical tools for them navigating the world, because we don't know, we just don't know what the future will be. And if people are locked into a digital prison and something malfunctions, you're going to want people who can do real hands-on things. So I still advocate for that. Whatever people can do to buy physical books, I advocate that. So they can't just manipulate, the Constitution is online, or our United States Constitution, and you go look, and they tweak things. They edit it. The Bible is online, and of course they tweak it. And regardless of one's worldview, I recommend everybody have their children read the Bible, because our founding, the United States founding fathers were not all Christian, contrary to what a lot of people think. And most of them had no formal education, but they had all read the Bible. And if you look at the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Papers, that was considered fourth grade reading level at the time. Now I send like a paragraph of that to people I consider very intelligent and erudite today, and they're like, this is over their heads, and it's because they don't have the foundational tools. We're not taught the trivium anymore, which is just the grammar of logic and rhetoric, which I think if people were just given that, they would be so much better off, and we would be in a much better position to fight against a lot of this globalization, centralized world governing body that they're trying to push us into. And really, I think the world religion they're trying to push us into, I think, is an AI religion. That's what it looked like. It looks like a cyber Satan to me. Anyway, that was a lot. I don't know if it answered anything, but those are
No,
kind of
it did.
two things.
Wow, though. I think there needs to be definite. What I agree completely with what you say about, like, If you build something in the middle of nowhere, if you want to get off grid, you get off grid together. It's never really
Yes.
off grid. You create your own grid, and that grid has got to be a really strong as well. It's got to be something where everybody's basically under pressure. You'll know where you'll act. That's when it's important. The rest of the time you can get on with the stuff, but when it's under pressure, because like you say, the tests of creating these mega city cyber gulag sort of infrastructure, it's going to be both trial and error. So there's going to be, there's going to be moments where the something collapses in a way. I mean, I know around, I live in the city, and I know that some of the people around here would turn rough pretty quick if they didn't have enough food. Really rough, pretty quick. There would be death. There would be death for anywhere. And that does branch out. So you need to build a community. Well, for me, I live in an area where I know everybody around here, but I also know that they are not ready for what could happen and could be around the corner. They are so far from being prepared in
Or even
anyway.
aware that there's a possibility they need to be prepared. That's what
Yeah,
I
and what you're talking about with the Bible is just like classical allegories and fables have been taken out of
exactly.
our society for a reason. Just keep us, and that I say to people that I remember that specifically when I must have been about probably five, maybe younger, that we were told by a teacher that they had changed the clerk. A clerk curriculum. Woo! Took a couple of times to say it.
Got
I deal with words, but yeah, they changed the curriculum, and they were going to be taking out Roman and Greek stuff out of it completely. We were going to learn about kings and queens of England instead. And we'd learn about the elites and the monarchy and all of their shiny goods and how cool it was when they took people to battle and how funny some of them were when they went mad and killed a load of people. Ho, 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 ho. So, yeah. And what we're t when you say taking kids out of school, I mean, the school systems, that takes a lot like that. That takes, you have to really be brave. But I think there's a load of people I know who are just like, on normie land, but ready to step across that breach within just what it'll be one thing that'll happen in society, and they'll be like, "Oh, no way, I'm not having that." I mean, the one thing that is the most one of the most stable things is that what you were saying earlier, in a sense, is what a woman scorned. Yeah,
Right,
you don't want to piss them off because they will just say no, and that means no. So
right. I
and.
know.
Yeah, that was a brilliant conversation. I really liked talking with you.
I do too. Yeah. So
That's
fun.
I think that is like you've got so many so much in areas that I am completely clueless about. I got like a bit of knowledge here and a bit of knowledge there from what I pick up along the way, but I
Sure.
kind of like center and focus in on researching certain things. So I love how broad your interest is. There was one thing you said about dreams. You said a lot about dreams. You said loads about dreams. And I
Interestingly,
suppose, do you get people instantly when you talk about your work, you're like studying dreams and stuff like that? Did you get people saying, "Can you tell me about this dream?"
oh my
This
gosh, my whole life. Yeah,
yeah.
and what's so interesting about that is that people don't realize how personal they are.
I know, I
And
know, I know. I
so I'll
had
be
one the
like
other day,
out.
and I want to say, because I've been thinking about it for a week and a half, but instead, I think I'll leave it out just in case everybody works out that I'm
No, I mean
gonna
we can, or and we could also do
die.
it offline too. It's a totally up to you. But I always warn people because people often approach me in like a group setting and be like, "Oh, I had this dream. Can you tell me what it means?" And and that's not actually how I work. I believe in empowering the dreamer. I want to. That's why I loved Gail Delaney's method. It was the interview method. Really funny side story about this though. When I did my research, my senior year, because I did 2 years, I did the junior year and then I did my senior year. My cousin was living with us at the time, and he was watching the research that I was doing, and he told me, he said, this dream stuff is that's great that you're doing that, but I think that you're gonna grow up to be like, a Diane Sawyer or a female Larry King. And I was so offended. I remember like I was like, why? I'm gonna be a neuropsychiatrist. Like, I'm gonna get a Nobel Prize because that's when I first presented my research as a junior. I could present it to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York City, and they laughed at me. I mean, I was 15 years old, and they said, it's a human brain study. You would need an MD, PhD to conduct a study. However, it would most likely, if you were to conduct it, would most likely garner you a Nobel Prize because I think that the findings would be statistically significant. And I said, oh, okay. And, all starry eyes. Oh, okay, I'll do that. And they said, but you probably shouldn't bother because by the time you get your degrees, we'll have already conducted the study. It's a fascinating, research. And
Horrible.
so I realized in hindsight, it was total gatekeeping. And it was really kind of ludicrous because, I wasn't going to slice the brains, that and it would be the surgeons who would do that, the neurosurgeons. And you don't need to know how to code to run a software company, right? So I was just, it was my research that I'd be outlining and I would oversee, and conduct the study, but I wasn't going to be involved in every facet of executing it, like, doing the brain study itself. So it was actually kind of ludicrous to me in hindsight. But at the time, I was like, oh, well, that's what I'm going to do, and I'll get a Nobel Prize. And it was very naive and very starry-eyed of me. But I was actually kind of offended when he told me that. And I said, why? Why would you say that? And he said, because the stream stuff is, it's interesting, and you're doing great stuff. But really, I think your talent lies in the interview. And it's, I hadn't thought about it for years until I started the podcast. And I
Yeah,
was like, huh.
sneaky deaky. It
I
happens like
was like,
that.
that's really interesting.
And definitive. I'll say that my sister told me when I was young that when I was older I'd have a beard, and I got really angry with her. Oh, really angry. For the people listening to the podcast, it's a lie. It's all a lie. But
Yeah, so that was
Courtney Turner, quite incredible. So, where can people find you? And where's the best place? Because you're obviously on like Podbean and stuff like that, aren't you?
yeah, I'm on everywhere. The best place to probably find me is at CourtneyTurner.com. Again, that's like Courtenay, so it's CourtneyTurner.com, and that has links to all of my different platforms. I'm on, I think, 20 different audio, I think 5 or 6 different video platforms. I also have a website called Rebels, plural, for cause, for spelled out, for cause.com, and that's a festival we do. It's creative artists uniting for the sovereignty of everyone, and it's really just to give a platform and a voice to independent creative artists, because CIA art is really good. I really enjoy it, but I think that the independent voices need to be heard as well. So, it's true. Part of the reason they're so effective is because it's good. So, I really want, unfortunately, though, a lot of the good people who are independent either get co-opted and brought to the quote unquote dark side, if you will, or they just get silenced and, they really don't get a chance for their voice to be heard. And by voice, I don't just mean, musicians. It's musicians, comedians. I do aerial. It's the filmmakers, actors, and studio artists. But they use art so much for culture creation and social engineering of the masses. So it's I may not agree with all the voices that are presented, but I think it's really important that they have a chance to be displayed. And so we do that. That's Rebels for Cause. We had 53 acts in our last one, and it was 26 hours of content. So you can watch all of that through the website. And yeah, those are probably the best places to find me. And I'm all the social media, like the Twitter and the Instagram, but you can find that through my website too.
Some noble stuff there too. All right. Thank you for coming on the NewsPace
Thank
podcast.
you for having me.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.